Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Let me ask you a question. When something goes wrong, do you tend to bounce back or do you fall apart? When you have resilience, you're able to harness the inner strength that helps you rebound from a setback or challenge, such as a job loss, an illness, or a tragedy. If you lack resilience, you might get stuck in problems or even feel like a victim. And resilience happens within the person and between people, thinking about couples, families, any important relationships. Resilience is a process. And even though it won't make your problems go away, it can help you see past them, find ways to enjoy life and handle stress. If you aren't as resilient as you'd like to be, or your clients aren't as resilient as you'd like them to be, the good news is you can learn how. Because as therapists, we intuitively know that families, relationships, people, they have strengths, but they may not know how to fully maximize them. That's what we're going to talk about on the podcast today. What our guest and expert, Dr. Christy Epler, deems systemic resilience. In her new book, Cultivating Systemic Resilience in Therapy from Routledge, Christy brings together a collection of diverse voices to provide our profession's most comprehensive guide on what systemic resilience is and how therapists can enhance the lives and relationships of their clients. Based on contemporary training standards, this text emphasizes practice-based applications and focuses on diversity, equity, and inclusion. It is practical advice, not in the ivory tower of an academic or research. It's what you can use in the therapy room after you listen to a podcast like this. We're going to address how to foster resilience and your clinical treatment with individual and relational clients. We'll even talk about cultivating systemic resilience in your own life, because it's hard to coach resilience if we first can't tap into it in our own domain, the self of therapist. Christy Epler is a LMFT, a program director and professor at Seattle University's Masters of the Arts in Couples and Family Therapy program. She's an AMFT approved supervisor, and the focus of her research, clinical practice, and teaching is all around our topic today, systemic resilience. And she also is a socially justice oriented narrative therapist. We will be back after our informative talk with Christy. Christy Epler, welcome to the AAMFT podcast. I am so excited to talk about something that I think is a guy that likes common factors and looks for client strengths. We're going to talk about resilience today, but more important, systemic resilience, which I love it. This show is all about systemic therapies, systemic therapists. So why don't we talk about systemic resilience? But before that, we always like to know about our expert, their origin story, specifically how you got into MFT, and then your interest in studying and incorporating into clinical practice resilience.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk with you today. And my origin story, when I was undergrad, I was a literature major, and it helped me fall in love with stories from around the world, from local authors. And I just loved how when people were telling true or fiction stories, they were really helping to make sense of their world, not only for them, but for the reader as well. And so I thought to myself, what profession would continue this spark? And I heard about counseling. And at first, I wanted to be a school counselor. My mother was a teacher, elementary school, while I was growing up. And I was interested in the schools, but really thinking more about it, I thought family is what gives us life, what we grow up with. And I was really drawn to marriage and family therapy. After a master's in counselor ed, I applied to Michigan State and did my doctorate in marriage and family therapy and fell in love with the theories, the research, and the clinical work. And that's what started my career, both as a clinician and then also as an academic. Currently, I'm the program director at Seattle University, and I love seeing my students apply the theories of resilience while being systemic therapy interns. And I myself got my start studying resilience when I was at Michigan State. I was funded through a graduate assistantship looking at the resilience models and what factors kids needed to be successful in elementary school specifically, but throughout the lifespan. So I was happy to partner with Michigan State Extension and do trainings throughout the state talking about what is resilience and how can individuals and families and schools and communities bolster traits and processes that help promote successful living, being healthy, being connected, being adaptable.
So just to orient our listeners, let's give a brief history and describe where we are now with this concept of resilience.
Yeah, back in the early 90s, Emily Warner was conducting a longitudinal research study on the island of Kauai in Hawaii. And she was looking at kids who were in at-risk situations, that they were living in lower economic situations, that they maybe didn't have adequate nutrition, they had variable attendance at school. She wanted to know what the communities could help do so that these children would not only thrive, but survive. And she defined resilience as being connected, being able to meet goals that you set for yourself. So she really had this community-informed definition of resilience. So she published her longitudinal study and said that individual traits like aptitude, commitment, family traits, having somebody to care and support, and community involvement were all critical for kids to thrive and survive, to succeed in school, to meet their own goals. Later, many people might know John Segelman, who coined learned helplessness. And that's when you are discriminated against, not chosen, you often learn to feel badly or poorly about yourself. And Segelman later in his career actually flipped and said, if helplessness can be learned, could a positive outlook be learned as well? And so that started some of the positive psychology movement that said that individuals themselves need factors to thrive and survive. And so from there, psychological resilience really took off. And many of the current textbooks on resilience actually don't even cite the earliest study that Emily Warner did on community resilience. They tend to focus more on what individuals need. Drama Walsh, of course, has long studied family resilience and has looked at the factors that are needed for families to thrive using their transcendent belief systems, being involved in community, having economic resources, being flexible, becoming adaptable. And so there really is a rich history on looking at family, community, individual supports, the traits and process, the dynamics needed in order for people to navigate all of the tough situations they find in life, whether it be something that happens, grief and loss, something in the community, like a natural disaster, an economic downturn. All of these situations promote the need to be able to navigate the world, to be able to connect with others, to share the burden in order to move forward with life.
So your new edited volume cultivating systemic resilience in therapy, you have taken these concepts that we've talked about, psychological resilience, family resilience, and you've integrated to the term systemic resilience. So help us understand the similarities and differences between these terms, and as systemic therapist, why the term systemic resilience is probably a better fit for the way we look at our clients and the way we do therapy.
Yeah. So psychological resilience, I think, is really synonymous with grit and perseverance and picking yourself up by your bootstraps. And there may be a time and place for those constructs, but I think a lot of people during these difficult times we've been through are just becoming tired of thinking, I have to take hit after hit. There's an author, Brown, who talks about just not wanting to be called resilient again, because it's just, I'm tired of picking myself up after bad things happen. And especially people from minoritized communities who don't have access to many of the benefits people with privilege have, the psychological resilience can be tiresome. We think about trying our best and maybe not succeeding. And that's not always because of the effort we put into it. It's because there's not supportive communities. There's not people to listen or mentor us or inspire us. And so I differentiate psychological resilience from systemic resilience. And systemic resilience is a combined term from a Walsh's family resilience model. And then also Michael Unger has been doing a lot of work on multi-systemic resilience. And he has edited a book with chapters about resilience in Palestine, resilience in nature, many different diverse articles. And so thinking about the combination of family systems and larger community systems, I think systemic resilience really aligns with how MFTs do. And I think that many of the concepts from systemic resilience really are parallel to the core concepts in couples and family therapy or in marriage and family therapy. We look at how cohesive family systems or community systems are. We look at if they're adaptable. We look at the resources that they may have within the family and in the community. We look at the process of change over time. We look at building alliances. So I think clinicians are going to hear these terms and say, oh, that's a lot of what I do in my work. And I agree. I think good therapy is resilient. And at the same time, the previous literature has not always looked at what are a few things therapists are doing and can enhance in their work in order to cultivate resilience. And that was my inspiration for this text. I wanted to ask authors to write shorter chapters, since people are overwhelmed or tired these days, to really explore what significant things they do in order to promote resilience in their clients, in parenting structures, in their supervisees, and even in themselves. How do they take care of themselves to prevent burnout or cope with burnout and to think about their own resilience?
I love that, because I think when the majority of our listeners, frontline clinicians, and certainly we have academics and researchers that would find this interesting too, but the majority of listeners to the AMFT podcast, they want tools or concepts that will help them in the therapy room with their sometimes complex family system. So we're definitely going to talk about that today. You started out talking about the therapeutic alliance, which again, as we say, a necessary but not sufficient form of all therapy. It's hard to imagine an effective treatment without the alliance between the clients and the therapist. And it's, again, in systems thinking, it's a multifaceted alliance. It's tasks, goals, and bonds, and it's your alliance with each member in the room, the system together with the therapist, the clients without the therapist. It's a lot going on there. So how can we think about resilience as part of that therapeutic alliance?
I think a lot of it is done in the noticing and the observing. And I also like to, at this point, differentiate resilience from toxic positivity. Because I think there's the fear here, if I take a pro-resilient stance, that am I going to be a Pollyanna? Am I just going to cheerlead my clients? Am I going to dismiss any negatives that they say? And I say no to that, that we can be strength-based. We can look at systemic resilience without diminishing all of the suffering and the pain that clients present with. And it's definitely a delicate balance, but I also know that the connection with clients can be so strong because the narratives that they tend to bring into therapy is the therapist is going to look for what's going wrong. They're going to possibly think I'm doing a bad job with the situation that I've been handed. And really for therapists to take a balanced viewpoint and notice what they've tried and what they've done that's worked that might not have gotten them yet to the place they want to be, but they've taken steps along the process. I would like to differentiate toxic positivity from systemic resilience. And I think there is a possible assumption that if I take a stance of resilience when working with my clients, I will only be looking for things that they do right. I'll be minimizing the negativity. I won't be seeing the problem. And that's not what resilience is about. Resilience is a balanced approach to honoring what your clients are bringing, what they've tried, what their strengths are, without minimizing the pain and the suffering. We want them to still describe the hardship, to be able to talk about that, and for us to be fully present as they're telling their whole life story. And at the same time, resilience is about observing and noticing what has worked and what's going well, which the client might not be able to see, especially during these tough times. The noticing of how a caregiver and a child connect during session. What is the caregiver doing to make eye contact or to give the child affirmations? We can stop session and notice that and build on those strengths. And then we can also observe our own behaviors. One of the ways I had to learn to differentiate my own toxic positivity from resilience is I was always trying to make sense out of why things happen and assume the best in all situations, but it was exhausting. And so I was talking to my care community and they said, maybe this isn't the situation where you have to frame everything in the positive. Maybe you do need that time to slow down and lament or grieve what you have lost. And resilience allows the space for all of that. We don't have to force ourselves into seeing the positive, but we don't want to limit ourselves to either the negative or the positive, always taking this holistic view.
I always tell my clients and my students that I'm training for that matter, I'm not an optimist or a pessimist, I'm a realist. So I think a client's, no matter what their socioeconomic status, their educational background, they can represent real. And sometimes, and you have this experience too, as we both run MFT programs and train students, the therapist in training is very positive and they're just a positive person, but if it doesn't resonate with the client is real. So the way you are framing resilience and observing, which also like, when we think of how many students and therapists in training will listen to this show and what you can do in a supervision group too to give feedback to your colleague is notice the process and notice these resilient factors in the client and feed that back in a way that is organic without being toxically positive, as you said. Let's think about other ways that cultivating resilience benefits the therapist, both in a therapist in training and also experienced therapist, also a listener of the show.
Definitely. I think some of the strengths that the authors brought to this edited volume was in each chapter offering ways that therapists can reflect on their own dynamics. I'm thinking of a chapter on abolition and systemic resilience and the way we were parented ourselves. And if punishment was a part of that parenting process, can be an important factor in our development. And so that chapter really does a deep dive into what does liberation and what does positive parenting practices look like in order to enhance resilience. And then that's paired with another chapter on systemic resilience and attachment. And so looking at how being securely attached can support resilience, thriving, becoming who we want to be in our lives. And so each of the authors really took a practical approach to their topic, offering reflection questions for the therapist or clinical case examples or activities that you can use with clients. And that's what I thought was really missing in the realm of resilience and systemic resilience. Of there was more theoretical processing, and I wanted a text where clinicians could see what cultivating resilience looked like in session. And the authors really came through to offer really hands-on suggestion, tips, and life experiences that all of the authors used their own clinical and teaching experiences to put together their chapters, and that was much appreciated.
And before we tap into a dynamic with a client system, we have to figure out how it functions for us and our family of origin. So it makes sense that to do this work, but it's also very highly tied into self of therapist work, as you've mentioned. All right, now you've told us about these practical things. So I got to know your favorite resilience building practical tips, both when you're working with an individual or you're working with multiple people in the room?
Oh, my favorite. That's a great question.
Your favorite. You can name it. We want them to read the book, but a couple of things that you saw your very diverse group of authors highlight.
Yes. There's a chapter on contextual therapy and systemic resilience. And I'm a big fan of contextual therapy, and Ivan Borjomin-Nagy had the pleasure of having lunch with him before he passed. And I am just inspired by his work. One, because it is a theory that names justice specifically, and then also pushes us to think against neutrality when we work with families. And I love that because it shows the fluidity of resilience, that at sometimes we might have to partner with one person in a family in order to amplify their voice without ever harming the relationship of the whole. And we want to move in and out of those relationships. We don't want to get stuck, or we're just repeating the pattern of the family. And so I love the chapter and the specific techniques to build justice when you're working with families in order to support resilience. And that's throughout the checks, but I think specifically in the contextual family therapy chapter. And then with individuals, I really appreciate the work of Jennifer Goldbeck. Some people might know her as a professor at the University of Maryland, College Park. She's a data scientist. She went back to get a master's in psychology, and she is a social media influencer because she lives with 6 golden retrievers, and she likes to show the joy of golden retrievers. But building on Froma Walsh's work, she looked at resilience after the death of a pet, and she really gave tips about staying present, talking about a range of emotions, talking about something that some people just don't think should be a big deal, and standing up for yourself. And I really appreciate both that she built on Froma Walsh's work, who has done a lot about the death of companion animals, but also talked about really this range of emotions that so often people think we're either sad or we're joyful, but we can hold many emotions at the same time.
Yeah, I have read the book, and I do love that chapter because a pet is a part of the family too. And many times, especially a dog, man's best friend, is part of what gives people support, coping, and resilience. So when you lose an animal, it is a threat to resilience. And again, it's another example of how diverse your contributors are. These authors come from a range of different backgrounds. So along those lines, how do you think culture or context affects resilience?
Yes, the authors are from a range of backgrounds. And something that was important for me is that the authors located themselves. So they have a paragraph about themselves and their social locations that start each of the chapters. and how context matters. I'm really inspired by Dr. Raquel Martin. She wrote the first chapter on liberation and resilience. And we have to look at what challenges and barriers need to be removed. And we also need to look at the historical strengths, the wisdom of the ancestors that we might not know if we don't share the client's cultural background, but it's our job to learn and to be curious and to listen. And then also really design our interventions that meet the cultural backgrounds of our clients through their different ages, through their different presenting problems. And that can spark our creativity, which I love, that we can get out pen and paper. Dr. Martin says that we should all have laminating machines in our offices. Just if we make a card, we can laminate it, give it to clients. And I know that wouldn't work for everybody, and people do telehealth. So we might have to take a digital approach to that. But I love that it really sparks how we can be creative and practical in our work to promote resilience.
I mean, we're making a pretty strong argument, and it's hard to think there is an argument against tapping into client strengths and health and resilience. But what barriers do you think clinicians face when trying to tap into this?
Yes, and thank you for saying that, because I do feel sometimes that I'm preaching to the choir, although some of my students have started to push back a little bit on the term resilience, just because I think they think of it as grit of just taking hit after hit when you feel down. And I really want to come at it from, we want to support communities. We want to support relationships to be resilience oriented. And at the same time, it's not only people on social media who might push back against resilience. It's also many of our governing bodies as well. Although many of us attempt to write treatment plans using a strait, many insurance companies want to see what is a presenting problem and what are you doing to fix it and what are the outcomes. And I hope when people read the book, they really are inspired to think about resilience, not as an outcome, but as a dynamic process that happens over people's lives and relationships. And that's sometimes hard to codify in a treatment plan or a grant application, because we have to operationalize it. We have to take concrete steps. And the authors help us see ways that we can do that by taking a resilienced approach to using theory, to using interventions. But it's not something that comes as naturally when we're thinking about proving ourselves to the insurance company so we don't get those clawbacks. T and COAMPTA, not at resilience, but there's never been a requirement to include resilience specifically in programs. It would tend to fall under the contemporary issues. It's listed in our core competencies that are dated at this point. However, I think that MFT has always been a profession of being strength-based, and we're drawing from that work. And so many of the listeners, the clinicians might say, this is stuff that I already do. And I say, yes, excellent, keep doing it. And if it doesn't fit with your clients to use the term resilient, don't use it. I think there are probably a lot of terms out there that might be a better fit. And we've trickled around those as a research community. Do we call it flourishing? What do we call it? And I don't think there's ever going to be one term that works. But however clients think they're thriving and surviving and being their best selves in community, that's really what resilience means.
You've pointed this out several times already, but it makes sense. We think as systemic therapists, we learn the process is more important than the content many times. So this is a dynamic process, both within the individual and between people. And I think that's the way I view it too. And as you've highlighted today, resilient process that couples or families, that they may look like they're up against the odds, the whole greater than the sum of the parts, as we say, how do they come together to keep going, to persevere? So I think what you're saying is a natural fit for how systemic therapists think, but you're defining it and operationalizing it in a way that I think, well, will help practicing clinicians, but also perhaps people like COAMPTI and people that are trying to understand and codify, as you say, what this looks like. So it's interesting that many people think that you need some type of failure or setback or trauma in order to then ignite resilience.
No, and I draw on Peter Benson's work out of the Search Institute in Minneapolis. And what Dr. Benson did is look at the existing resilience models and say, what does everybody need? So often resilience was studied with people at risk. And the Search Institute under Dr. Benson really wanted to ask, what do we all need in order to thrive and survive? And many of the factors and processes are the same. We need support. We need somebody to cheer us on. We need to find purpose, to have reasonable hope. And also, we don't have to be at risk in order to cultivate those. That as therapists throughout our lives, I believe when we're newer therapists, we need to learn the skills to be flexible and adaptable, to create communities of support. And what that looks like over the lifespan of us being a therapist might change. But I would say even the most seasoned therapist comes across situations where they're drawing on those past situations where they have to see something in a new way, that they have to use somebody in their community to offer advice. They have to rely on those people to offer advice. And so I think I want to honor that resilience comes out of hard situations, but it's also for all of us. And I would argue that all of humanity has been through tough situations, and especially in these last 5 years, that we've all felt at different levels, isolation, concern, questions about life, questions about community. And so when we're thinking about resilience, when we're thinking about really making meaning together, we do that in the face of trauma. We do that in the face of everyday life, which offers joy and also is a source of sadness and grieving. And of course, these are always mixed together, that there's never one or another.
You mentioned NAGE in contextual family therapy, which is a classic model. Do you think resilience is specific to one or more therapy modalities, or is it imbibed in any good therapy?
I would say that the clinician has the opportunity to integrate it throughout many different family therapy theories and models. For example, if somebody is doing structural work and looking at rules and boundaries, what rules have ones need to be adapted? What boundaries have been respected? What are boundary crossings that we need to revision, revise, seek forgiveness for? So that would be an example of infusing resilience concepts into structural family therapy. There's one chapter in the book about diagnosis and resilience, which of course, many people hear diagnosis in there, though that's not a strength-based perspective. And point conceded, for sure, it doesn't have to be. But the author looks at using narrative family therapy and concepts from diagnosis or psychopathology and how it can be transformational to use a diagnosis as an externalization, like in narrative family therapy. So I would say some of the theories are more inherently strength-based. Solution-focused comes to mind, but I think you can take a resilience orientation with whatever theory or model that you're using with clients and really augment your own strengths in the process plus your client's strengths.
As a common factors practitioner, I couldn't agree with you more. And certainly, I think, as you mentioned, solution-focused, you're talking about your own background and narrative earlier. Most of our postmodern models that will prioritize a collaborative approach, the client as expert, is a just natural fit to do this. I also think of my supervisor hat. I think I'm curious of your thought of what our AMFT supervisors out there that listen to the show could do to incorporate this into the way we supervise young professionals.
Yes, thank you for asking. And your supervisor took on the challenge of writing a chapter for this book and did a wonderful job of creating a model. It's called Create, a model of resilience or model of supervision that incorporates resilience. And it really draws on the work from Ken Hardy, Aponte, Cheryl Storm, other greats in MFT supervision to look at how can we bolster what is working, what supervisors need, how to have them honor. They might not know what they need yet, balance their natural inclinations with being open to other perspectives, which is a source of resilience. So I love that chapter because it offers specific techniques. With new or seasoned therapists, my hope is even seasoned therapists occasionally go into consultation or brief supervision to update their skills. And this model can be used with interns, limited license clinicians, or people who have been in practice for years.
Yeah, and I love it. As we get ready to close, this has been affirming. Many of our listeners will do, hey, I do some of this anyway. And now they have a framework of not just resilience, but systemic resilience. Again, a process between and within clients, how to tap into that. I'm curious, if we look 5-10 years down the road, what you think the future of resilience is, both in clinical practice and in clinical research.
The words that come to mind are shared community, because I think what you're talking about is vicarious resilience. And this is from the work of Pilar Wolf Hernandez, talking about when clinicians are listening to very difficult stories, they're also listening for sources of resilience. And that changes us as clinicians, as academics, as researchers. And so I think the more we can share stories, especially from communities that have been underrepresented about how they've navigated difficult times, the more that we'll learn about our clients, the more we'll know what to research, the more we'll learn about each other. And especially coming off a time of lockdown and isolation and changing norms through COVID, I think really the power of listening, which of course all of the listeners of this podcast are committed to. So if we're committed to listening for resilience in situations that are like or unlike our own, the more we'll all be able to collectively thrive as a profession and as people.
Very well said. Again, the book, brand new, Cultivating Systemic Resilience in Therapy from Routledge. And if listeners of the show would like to continue the dialogue or follow up with you, Christy, what is the best way to get a hold of you?
The best way is email. And my email is fleurc@seattleu.edu.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast, where we seek to innovate, educate, and relate one episode at a time. Thank you very much, Christy Epler. I have read the book, and I think it is very practical, whether you are professionally young or seasoned, how to tap into systemic resilience. You can follow the AAMFT on Instagram, X, formerly known as Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn. Please stay up to date with the latest news in MFT. Speaking of the latest news in MFT, you may know that AAMFT, for the first time in years, is returning to a face-to-face conference setting. I am talking about the 2024 Systemic Family Therapy Conference in sunny Orlando, Florida, November 4th through November 7th at the world-famous Walt Disney Resort, Swan and Dolphin. If you haven't taken part in the last couple years in the virtual Systemic Family Therapy Conference, you've really been missing out. So this year, we can be face-to-face, as we are relational by nature. And it's designed as a reimagined approach to the traditional AAMFT annual conference that many of our listeners I have fond memories of. I remember at one point I had gone to 15 in a row and presented at like 12 or 13 of those. It was really a chance for me not only to learn about what is going on in the world of systemic therapy, but to connect with my friends that I'd only get to see a couple of times a year. And many of you, if you've never been, this is your chance. The Systemic Family Therapy Conference takes a holistic approach to the development and enhancement of family therapists. And just like our dynamic profession, this conference targets three key areas. One, the enhancement of the systemic thinker as an individual, focusing on personal and professional growth. Two, development of cutting-edge clinical skills and training that's going to propel our profession forward. And three, the integration into vital community and institutional systems that shape our global society. Better yet, there's up to 22 continuing education credits available. Again, November 4th through the 7th. Go to aamft.org to check it out. So if you liked our topic today on systemic resilience, you might also like checking out How to Enhance the Common Factors in Couple and Family Therapy. It's my book with current AAMFT president-elect Dr. Adrienne Blow, where we tap into these client factors and how to build the therapeutic reliance, how to tap in to these internal strengths your clients have. That's Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy. You can also check out my on-demand trainings and everything else going on in the world of Dr. Eli at elicarum.com. You can also drop me a line, as I love hearing listener feedback, and many times our shows are driven by this correspondence. You can get a hold of me at eli@northstarcounselingcenter.com. Please check us out wherever you find your favorite podcast. I'm partial to Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can have six seasons of hot topics and the movers and shakers in the world of couple and family therapy, systemic therapy. As always, thank you for your support. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.